Sometimes the fun begins when the paved road ends. Chevy Silverado 2500 HD is made to work hard and play hard on the road or off. Go to ChevyDriveChicago.com for details and experience life in HD.
Hi, I'm Shadow Stevens. On this episode of Nostalgia Stories, WGN's sister station Antenna TV spoke with Peter Asher. Listen as we chat with Peter about producing and more on this episode of Antenna TV's Nostalgia Stories. Did you get your start as a child actor working with Boris Karloff? Is that a true story?
I did work with Boris Karloff. That wasn't the first thing I did, but I did have the privilege of working with him. He was in England at the time filming a detective series called Colonel March of Scotland Yard, and I was in one episode. But I'd done some acting before that. Well, you have to remember, of course, that I was 10 or something, so I had not seen any of those horror movies. I wasn't allowed to. I was not aware of how scary Boris Karloff was supposed to be, and he was charming. So I know there was no conflict there because I didn't know he was Frankenstein.
How did you start your acting career?
I have two sisters, Jane and Claire, 2 years younger and 2 years younger again. And we all got signed up by an acting agent at a very young age. I was 8, Jane was 6, and Claire was 4. And we got spotted by this agent, probably because we all had red hair and were sort of graded in height and looked allegedly, you know, like cute kids. And so I imagine the agent was imagining some highly paid TV commercial or something, which never happened. We never actually did anything, all three of us together. But we did all start acting as children. And in my case, I gradually stopped. By the time I was about 14 or 15, I was taking school seriously and stopping acting. Yeah, I went to Westminster School, which is kind of a serious school in London. And that's what really, I mean, at least that's my excuse for my acting career tapering off. But my sister Jane, as you may know, went on. She quit school at 15, became an actress full time, and has become very successful at it.
How did you get into music?
Music as an overall thing came into my life very early on. I grew up in a musical household. My mother was a professional classical musician. She was oboe professor at the Royal Academy of Music. My father was an amateur pianist. He was a doctor, but he was an amateur pianist, big Gilbert and Sullivan fan and so on. So I grew up in a very musically oriented household. There was music everywhere. And but I suppose it was probably around 14 or 15 when I started becoming a big rock and roll fan. Skiffle, which was the rage at the time in England. I had a skiffle group, and it also, of course, was at Westminster School when I was already a big music fan. I was also a huge jazz fan, but I was never a good enough musician to play bebop at all. But it was at that point, yes, that music kind of took over, and that's where I met Gordon Waller, who became my singing partner, and that was the beginning of us sort of singing together, unprofessionally, not for work initially, just for fun or parties, and eventually actually getting paid to do it, which was wonderful. You get invited to come play at parties and things, and the first thing you notice is you're getting invited by people you don't know to their parties. They go, oh, I'm having a big party on Saturday. You do come. Oh, by the way, bring your guitars. And you realize you just got booked for a free gig. But that's how you get better, so you do it.
How'd you get the song with Paul McCartney?
How did we get the song? It's a slightly complicated story. But, you know, my sister Jane, as I said, became a very successful actress. My sister Jane was a well-known actress, kind of a film star in England at the time. And it was in that capacity, as a celebrity, who was known to love music, who was invited to go and see the Beatles when they first came down to London. The Radio Times, which is a magazine, wanted to do her to do a kind of review of the Beatles the first time they came down to London, of what was all the fuss about, why were all the girls screaming and so on. And she was happy to do this because she'd never heard them. She went to the show, loved it. I thought the music was wonderful. As the visiting celebrity, she was taken backstage to meet them all afterwards. She met them, liked them very much, found them to be charming and witty and all the things that we now know them to be. And she liked them, they liked her, one of them liked her in particular, and asked her out. So that's how she ended up going out with Paul McCartney for a number of years. And one of the effects of that was that he was hanging around our house all the time. And eventually, our parents offered him the guest room at the top of the house next to my bedroom. So he moved in and he and I shared the top floor of that house for 2 years. So that's how I heard the song, because it was an unfinished song. But at the same time, what had been happening is Gordon and I had been working more and more, and we're working in a place called the Pickwick Club, One night in the Pickwick Club, we were spotted by a talent scout from EMI Records who signed us up and we got a record deal. And we signed the deal and everything, and Norman Newell, our producer, had some songs in mind that we'd already been doing in our show that he wanted us to record. But in addition, he said, you know, do you know any other cool songs that you might want to record? And that's when I thought to myself, well, perhaps I do. Because I had heard this song called World Without Love that Paul had been playing. And I'd asked Paul about it, and he'd explained that it was, in fact, an unfinished song. It was actually a reject. John didn't think it was right for the Beatles. He thought the opening line of lyrics, "Please Lock Me Away," was kind of silly. Apparently, Paul would try and sell John on the song by singing, "Please Lock Me Away," and John would go, "Okay, you can stop now. I will lock you away. Song's over." So they clearly were not going to record it. So when we had a record deal in place, that's when I went to Paul the following night and said, "That song that I liked that you hadn't finished, has anything happened to it, or is it still an orphaned reject?" And he said, no one's doing it. So I said, well, can we have a go at it? You know, I think we could do a version of it. And so he said, yes. So he wrote out the words and the lyrics for me and made a little demo, and we learned the song, and it went on the list for our very first session. So that's how it came our way.
How did the song with Paul, you know, change your life?
Completely. I mean, I was a philosophy student at London University, and suddenly we had a number one record, and I quit university and was a pop star. I mean, if you think about it, I mean, one minute I was, you know, on a winter's afternoon, I would be bicycling home from school from a philosophy lecture in the rain, being England, and in the dark at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And a year later, I was driving down Sunset Boulevard in a rented Mustang in Los Angeles, being recognized by beautiful women. So it was an improvement.
What was it like touring in America?
We were being chased by screaming teenage girls. Life was very good. It was great. I mean, we'd always dreamed of going to America. We wanted to go to America desperately anyway. It was where all this music came from that we were in love with. So to go there for the very first time as a pop star with a number one record at the height of this British mania, you know, Americans have convinced themselves that somehow if you were English, you were more intelligent, more interesting than anybody else, which is ridiculous. It's amazing we could get away with it.
Did the group break up?
We never had a big Everly Brothers level fight or anything. We didn't say that's it. We started doing other things, and we went on to kind of a extended hiatus. I knew I wanted to produce records, and I set out a plan to accomplish that. Gordon wanted to make a record on his own and do some other stuff. So we drifted into not working together. And I must admit, as the drift extended, it went on for, you know, a year, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, 30 years. I assumed that we were never going to sing together again, but in fact, we did.
Do you enjoy producing more than performing?
And the answer is that what I like best is the fact that I do get to do all of them. So I would not choose. I suppose if I was absolutely restricted to one profession, it might be record producer, because I love doing that. I enjoy being in the studio very much.
How did you end up working with Apple Records?
Well, it was exciting. I mean, Paul and I were friends, obviously, and he knew that I was producing records, and he actually played on some stuff I'd produced. He was aware of my work. And so he asked me first if they could get this idea off the ground, this record label they wanted to start. And I talk about some of this in my show this evening, but he asked me if I would produce some records, and I said, of course I will. I'd love to. And then as the label became real, he asked me if I would be head of A&R for the label, which is being in charge over all everything that gets signed and what gets made and so on. So I happily accepted that role. It was exciting. They were very exciting to work for. I mean, it was unpredictable, and they weren't necessarily all saying the same thing at the same time. But it was obviously, you know, ideal working for a brand new, exciting record label, and working for the Beatles was thrilling. And they were so brilliant, you know, to get to see them at work from time to time, in the studio or in the office or whatever, was fascinating.
What is your relationship with James Taylor?
Well, yes. I mean, I heard James quite separately from Apple. I was introduced to him by a mutual friend. Heard him, went crazy, loved him. I wrote a memo to Apple, which I also show in the show. And at the time, basically says, and it actually is headed, item one, James Taylor, who's an American singer-songwriter who's extremely good. And it so happened I was in a position to go, look, I can sign you. I've got a record, you know, I'm working for this new record label. And would you like a record deal? And he went, yes, please, I'd love one. And that was that. So And I brought him into the office, explained to him whose label it was. He met the Beatles and they loved it too and all that. So yes, and the first record did okay, didn't do particularly well, but more significantly than that, the whole company was starting to fall apart. This guy, Alan Klein, was coming in, whom I didn't like, and I was decided to leave anyway. So at that point, James and I both left Apple. And that's when, yes, I made the decision. He and I decided that I should become his manager because we didn't know anybody else we trusted to do it. So I became his manager as well and basically went to America and bet my career on his, yes. Because I was confident. I thought he was incredibly good. I couldn't conceive of him not being successful. And that kind of sums it up. And I was right. He is extremely good. He was then and he is now. And we remain great friends.
How'd you come across Linda Ronstadt?
I was in New York and somebody said, you should go and hear this girl who's singing at the Bitter End tonight. She's amazing. She's got the most amazing voice you ever heard in your life. And she sings barefoot in very short shorts and she's insanely hot. And it was all true. So and then on top of that, I met her and found out she was one of the most extraordinarily well-read, erudite, brilliant women it's ever been my privilege to know. I don't know if you've seen the documentary that's out now, but it's amazing. It's brilliant because it is a tearjerker, but it also captures how remarkably intelligent and extraordinary Linda is and that she's one of the best singers in the history of music. And I believe that very strongly. So, yeah, we worked together for about 25 or 30 years.
Weren't you involved with the Roxy?
I think it was our friend Lou Adler who had the idea initially. It was Lou Adler, David Geffen, Elliot Roberts, myself, Elmer Valentine, who was the guy who ran the Riskier Go-Go, who knew the club business, and a guy called Chuck Landis, because he owned the lease. It was a strip club. So in order to change it from a strip club to a rock and roll club, we brought him in. And we all started this club and each put in a chunk of money and decided that L.A. needed a good rock and roll venue, which it didn't have. Had the Troubadour, but at the time the Troubadour was strictly folky.
Are you credited for creating 70s Cali sound?
Yes, I have been credited as you know, the soft sound of California rock and all that stuff. I suppose maybe it's true. The irony is, of course, that that California rock, none of us were from California. I mean, it may be that we made the records there, but if you think about it, you know, I'm English, James is from the East Coast, the Eagles are all from Texas, Linda's from Arizona. I can't think of a single Joni's from Canada. I can't think of a single California rock icon who actually came from California. But California's that's what's cool about LA in a way is that people go there and meet each other and do interesting stuff, and that's what happened musically. There are very few actual Californians involved, but yes, we all used LA as a working base.
What sound genre would you say you have created?
Gosh, I don't know. I mean, I've been accused of making records that were too kind of neat and accurate, you know, suggesting that they might be sort of soulless, which I don't agree with. But I mean, I do like records that are fairly precisely made, I admit. But the sound, I don't know. It's the sound of a lot of great musicians coming together. And I had the privilege of being there and helping some of them make records. You know, if you think about it, whether it's the Byrds or the Mamas and the Papas or Linda and Joni and all the people who showed up there, it was a great place to meet. And it's the sound of great music, great musicians discovering each other, I think.
What was it like working with Robin Williams?
Robin Williams was an exceptional case. Robin was one of my best friends, and he'd asked me to help him make a comedy album. And I had some ideas of things I thought about Robin that we could try to capture. But most significantly, it really consisted of recording all the shows, taking a lot of notes, picking all the best bits. And I would make notes about which takes I thought were particularly good. You know, the golf sketch was great in Milwaukee or whatever it was. And so I would go over all the stuff afterwards and worked with Robin's manager, David Steinberg, who's a terrific guy, and Robin's wife at the time, Marsha, who's a great friend and brilliant. And Robin essentially took my word for it, our word for it, because he doesn't have the patience to sit and listen to himself for hours, which is, I found, enthralling.
Do you have a favorite album or project?
No, I would never say that, but I don't. I really, truly don't. But I do like you know, hits, I have to admit. I'm fond of hit records. You know, I love listening to Top 40 Radio today, because when you hear a record, that's going to be huge. You know, I love that. So, yes, I have a soft spot for Power and Rain and You're No Good and the records that have become, you know, sort of certified successes. When we finished You're No Good with Linda, I was kind of going, if that's not a hit record, I don't know what I'm doing, you know, because that just sounds so good. You know, you get excited about your own work and Linda's work. And it was. It was number one all over the place. So you're going to go, thank goodness for that. But no, there's lots of, and I could go through all the records I've ever done and pick out some little hidden gems of tracks that people don't notice that are great. But I did an album with 10,000 Maniacs, two albums with them. I thought we'd create Natalie Merchant, such a wonderful singer. And I've had the pleasure of working with some just extraordinarily great singers, and I've loved them all.
You also worked with Steve Martin and Edie Brickell.
That was a great record to make. It began, I was having dinner with Steve in New York, and he'd written some beautiful banjo pieces, which he does a lot. I spent New Year's Eve with Steve, and he played me one he's just written that's beautiful. I'm figuring out what we should do with it. But it's a gorgeous melody. But in this case, he'd sent a couple of them to Edie, who'd heard them at a party. He'd played them to her, and she'd said, can I write a tune for that? And he said, sure. And we thought she was just maybe going to just write words to the existing banjo melody, instead of which she invented a whole new beautiful melody that fit over the top of this banjo piece. And so Steve played me these three or four things Edie'd sent him over dinner, and I said, this is great, this is amazing, you have to make a record, this has to be a record. And I sent him a bunch of notes on how I thought it should be done, I was on the plane home the next day, and he emailed me back saying, I've told you, Edie, do you want to produce the record? I went, yes, please. Yes, 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 I wrote, actually. And it was a great record to make. She's an incredible, another amazingly good singer, just fantastic, incredibly in tune, incredibly in time, it's perfect. Well, I only produced one album with Bonnie. I've known her forever. I love Bonnie. She's one of the greatest singers in the world. We did one album called The Glow.
Did Mike Myers use you for inspiration?
Yes. The look of it. I talk about that in the show as well. You'll see. I have some evidence of it. But not necessarily the character, but the look of Austin Bowers, he has said, derived from some photos of me back in that era. Because he wanted something that looked very 60s. So I guess the glasses, with Buddy Holly glasses and the bad teeth, which I'd fixed when I came to America, but they're bad in the photos. And he copied all that. Mike, I'm happy to say, is now a friend and is a great devotee of my radio show, which is exciting. He's great and brilliant. And yes, I'm proud to have contributed to the look of a master spy.
Thanks for listening. Check out other episodes of Nostalgia Stories at wgnradio.com/antennaTV. Or for video versions of this podcast, go to youtube.com/antennaTV.